Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. The Donald on the Kitchen show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. More information can be found at www.themuckyduckpub.com or from Marcus at telephone number 232-8888. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal, and my cohort, Donna Pruskintis, is a little under the weather today, so she is hopefully resting and feeling better. We come to you, this Donald on the Kitchen show comes to you from the studios of KHOI Community Radio, and I want to emphasize the community part of this community radio station. We really are supported and owned by the community, and thank you for your support. Well, I have been putting up the bounty. This year, this time of year, you get boxes of things and pails of things, and people drop off fruit, and they say, here, you can use this. And you say, oh boy, I don't want to see another box of tomatoes, but you don't want to turn anything down. I have a food dryer experiment to report. I was given some watermelons and some cantaloupe that were bruised, you know, that they were, not all of them were good, but I had quite a few of them, and I love melon. I love watermelon. I can eat lots, but I could not eat these half a dozen that were left over, and so I tried drying cantaloupe and tried drying watermelon in my food dryer. I wish to report that it is the dandiest thing. It is so good. You end up with little melon candies. Yes, you do. The cantaloupe seemed to work a little better. I don't know why. They didn't stick to the food dryer as much, probably because the watermelon was a little soggier to start with. I don't know. I must mention that this stuff was really dead ripe. And luckily, the watermelon were these small seedless kinds, so I didn't have to go through picking out seeds. But cut these watermelon or cantaloupe or melon or whatever you cut. Get rid of the rinds. Cut them into little, well, maybe quarter to half inch size slabs. And it doesn't really matter what shape that is, but lay them on the, I have an electric food dryer, lay them on the little plastic sheets there. And it took a while, of course, to get rid of the excess water in the fruit, but boy, is that good. And like I said, the cantaloupe just popped right off and is in a sealed jar in a dark space right now. It's really tasty. The watermelon was a little harder to come off. I should have perhaps slightly oiled the pan, but I didn't. So I wish to reply that there are successes happening in the putting food by department. Yes, they are. They candied themselves. Dried melons. Ooh, what a good invention. I have a few news items here, local news items. Donna heard from the ISU Hort Farm this week, and the recent huge windstorm, the derecho that went through, kind of did a business on their apple harvest this year. So things may be a little shy in the apple harvest department from the ISU Hort Farm. And also another news item, I talked to Jessica Kupica, who is the Farm to Folk CSA coordinator, and community-supported agriculture has had to adapt because usually a CSA, you go and pick up at a central location, you get to meet your farmer, you get to talk, you get to get good food every week, and the face-to-face stuff has not been happening. So they have been adapting by doing a lot of stuff online, and there is a pickup at a local front porch, and it seems to be working good. Actually, Jessica says that there is a huge interest in local food. There have been way too many more subscribers applying to Farm to Folk CSA this year than they ever had room for. So we hope that they keep having this interest. And if you have information or if you have things you would like to find out about community-supported agriculture, you can go to the Farm to Folk, that's a local website, Farm to Folk website, FARMTOFOLK.com. And that will connect you up with one CSA. There are many other CSAs in the neighborhood. And people are definitely more interested in where their food is coming from. Yes. The COVID pandemic, hurricanes, derecho winds in the Midwest, wildfires on the West Coast, salmonella, contaminated food recalls nationwide, meatpacking health concerns. Our big food supply chain is not as steady as we once thought. It seems more of us are getting into gardening and finding old ways to feed ourselves. And it's always good to share with friends and neighbors what they know. Today on the Donna Lana Kitchen, Nick Odey is joining us, and he has a lot to say about local food and how to feed yourself. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me, Lana.
Good. Nick Odey has been on our show before because if you want some good information on how to cook things or whatever, he knows. He's the Communications Director for Practical Farmers of Iowa, and he does a lot of other things too. So, Nick, you sent me an email recently, and I want to know what's up with you. You mentioned an encounter with a turtle. And listen, folks, this is not just turtle as in for fun. We're talking food. I've had turtle. So what about turtles, Nick?
Well, I think one of the things about hunters and outdoors people in general is that we are opportunistic. So we're always having our heads on a swivel and looking for opportunities for new things to eat when we're out in the field. And I just happened to be scouting a nearby wetland for hunting ducks later in the year. And I noticed a large snapping turtle out on one of the mud flats, and I had never actually prepared a snapping turtle before, but we had snapping turtle fairly often growing up. My dad would often catch snapping turtles and fix them for us, and I remember them being quite delicious, and I'm always up for a challenge of butchering a new animal and cooking a new animal. And so I called him up and said, well, how do I get this thing? Like, how do I even go about getting I would suspect that the snapping turtle was shell maybe 12 to 15 inches long and, 6 inches wide, something like that. Pretty large animal, maybe weighed 15 pounds or so.
And they're called snapping turtle because they bite. They bite.
They have a powerful and fast snap. The snaps that I saw, I thought about it as like a frog sticking his tongue out to catch a fly. It's that fast, which is not what you expect from a plodding snapping turtle. You have to pick it up by the tail and hold it away from your body enough so that they can't grab a hold, which is difficult not only because of the really powerful jaws and snapper, but they also have sharp, long claws. When you really look at it, the first thing you think is the first thing I thought was Stegosaurus. I mean, it really seems like a dinosaur, and they're really a strange animal. So I picked it up, put it in the back of my truck, and took it home for butchery.
Ooh. You said you found this in a pond, or so were you like waist deep to get this, or was it on the edge?
It was on the edge, and it actually, when I told my dad where it was, he said, well, how deep's the mud where the snapping turtle is? Because basically, if there's any kind of off balance, picking up the snapping turtle is probably not a very good idea. But it was on a mud flat with that was fairly firm ground. And actually, there were several other snapping turtles on that same mud flat. So evidently, you know, maybe they're going there. Snapping turtles hibernate in the mud over winter. So maybe they were going there to hibernate, something like that. But yeah, it was on a mud flat next to some water on a wetland.
Okay, so you've got a turtle in the back of your truck. Is it still alive, or does one kind of how does one deal with the snapping turtle?
So snapping turtles, the way that I've come to understand snapping turtles is that the boundary between a live snapping turtle and a dead snapping turtle is not the same boundary that we've come to expect in most other animals. Most of their systems really operate independently from each other. And disrupting that system doesn't necessarily mean that the other parts of the system don't continue to function. So I think you're probably familiar with the concept of the chicken running around the yard with the head cut off. The snapping turtle, I would say, shares that characteristic, and that is amplified many fold in their biological system. So it's quite the experience to butcher the snapping turtle, and there's not really a singular way that you're going to end the snapping turtle's life as people who have experienced snapping turtles meeting their semi-natural end, such as getting hit by a car, maybe getting hit by a mower or something on a farm. It's never for a snapping turtle. It's never a quick death, according to at least my understanding of the species.
So we're still talking claws that bite and claws that catch, that sort of thing.
That's right. So throughout the butchering process, with any animal, the neurons in the muscle tissues are continuing to fire after what we would say the animal's death is, right? We would say that something happens at some point and the animal dies, but yet neurons are still firing in different parts of the body. For the turtle, it's a much more extensive process. And so, that butchering process, you really have to take precautions to neutralize, like, let's say the snapper and the claws, so that while you're butchering it, the firing of those neurons isn't causing you to get cut or something like that.
Ooh, sounds dangerous. So what part are you going for? What do you eat out of the turtle?
So there's a lot of meat on a turtle. The ratio of non-edible things to edible things is pretty favorable on a turtle. So that turtle, I suppose, weighed 10 or 15 pounds, like I said. And I weighed the meat that I took off of it, and there was 5 pounds of meat off of a turtle. So it's a substantial amount of meat. You know, that might be too large, the same amount of meat as two large pheasants or two large mallard ducks or something like that. So there's a lot of meat per the animal. So the neck is the delicacy. It's a white meat. It's sort of flaky, somewhere in between maybe a firm fish, the texture, not the flavor, of a firm fish and let's say maybe a chicken. And then the rest of the animal is dark meat. So all the meat on the legs and stuff like that is all dark meat. And that's somewhere, something like maybe a pork shoulder or a chicken thigh, something like that.
Oh, for goodness sakes. Now, okay, remembering my science classes. So the bones or the skeleton of the turtle is on the outside. So inside the shell, what do you find?
So inside the shell, so you're right that there's the shell on the top and then the shell on the bottom, but it actually has arms and legs. And the spine is actually built into the shell. Oh. So for example, the loins are almost in the shell. So there's not very much meat on the loin, but I did clip some of the, I guess you would call them ribs, but they're part of the shell, to get the loins out. And they were also white meat, kind of tender little morsels. But yeah, so the bones are very strange. The front shoulder or the front legs are sort of in between, like, you know, humans have collarbones, deer have a floating shoulder so that it's not connected to the rest of their body by a bone or a socket joint. It's just floating, connected by muscle and stuff. The turtle's infrastructure there is like a scapula coming in and then another bone that's connecting the two arms and then another bone that's coming down that makes the actual arm. So it's like a three bones pointing in three different directions, which creates some problems if you want to brown. If you can imagine sticking this three-pronged piece of meat into the frying pan to brown it, it's quite the little challenge.
Ah, goodness. Goodness. So what did you make out of your turtle meat?
Yeah, so I, since it was the first time I'd cooked it, you know, you always hear everyone talking about turtle soup, or maybe you don't hear that many people talking about it. But when you do hear about turtle, you hear about turtle soup. But I decided to follow my dad's guidelines pretty specifically since he'd made it a lot. And what I did, just followed those guidelines directly, which was season some flour, roll all the pieces in flour, brown those pieces, put a little water and onions in a Dutch oven, bake it at 350 for 3 hours, and it was perfect.
Perfect. A turtle. A snapping turtle. And see, here on the Donalana Kitchen, you got some good information for your next turtle adventure. Oh, that sounds great. That sounds great. If one was specifically looking for a turtle to eat, like you said, you could eat turtle or catch turtle anytime. Do people go out just specifically looking for turtle, or they just kind of stumbled on them?
Yeah, I would suspect that there aren't too many turtle. The way that you would, if you were looking to seek out turtles, you would more than likely try to trap them. You know, so for there is a commercial trapping season for turtles, in that you can actually trap them and then sell the meat or animal with an appropriate license for recreational, you know, anglers, people like that. If you have a fishing license, you can catch turtles in whatever way that you can. And I think the limit is four snapping turtles a day. But you do need a fishing license. As far as going out specifically for turtles, I think probably the vast majority of turtles that are consumed are a element of happenstance. Maybe they're crossing a road. Maybe you see them like what I did. But the people who are going after turtles, and I imagine it's just like any other element of trapping, is that there's fewer and fewer of them. There were turtle trappers on Lake Odessa, where I grew up in southeast Iowa, commercial trappers who were probably selling the meat or turtle. There are, I would suspect that if it's like other commercial fishermen and other commercial trappers, there are far, far fewer. And probably not very many today, but that would be the main way that people would intentionally catch snapping turtles is through traps.
Oh, turtles. Let's move from turtles to another thing that you go after this time of year. Let's talk ducks. Ducks!
Okay.
So that happens now? Duck hunting is now?
So tomorrow is actually the last day of an early duck season, specifically for two species of teal ducks, green-winged teal and blue-winged teal. And the reason that the Iowa DNR has opened a special season for teal is that blue-winged teal particularly migrate much, much earlier than other ducks. And so by the time the rest of the duck season is open, most of the blue-winged teal have already migrated through. So to give the hunters an opportunity to hunt that particular species, they've opened a special season in September, and this has been open for the last maybe 10 years or so, where teal are the only legal waterfowl that you can take during that season. And so that's a good opportunity for hunters to get out early in the year and kind of kind of get shake the dust off and get their equipment working and shoot some teal, which teal are a much smaller duck. They're a very small duck. I'd say that one teal is an appropriate meal for a single person. It's a small duck.
Can you okay, so you're out in the field. Can you tell one duck from the other when they're flying over?
Yep, and so actually there's some specific regulations with regards to teal that help prevent people from shooting other species of ducks that aren't legal animals in that season. And of course, when you're hunting, you should always know what species of duck you're shooting, because the regulations are different for different species of ducks throughout the entire year. So you can shoot different numbers of different species of ducks, and that's all based on the DNR and Fish and Wildlife Service monitoring of those duck populations to make sure that they're staying steady. And for teal specifically, the hunting hours are changed a little bit. So you can take teal starting at sunrise instead of starting a half hour before sunrise to prevent mistakes being made by hunters confusing teal for other species of ducks.
Okay, when you hunt, you have a dog to do all the traipsing around and all, and also you have like a duck blind you have to hide?
Yeah, so there's all kinds of different configurations, and duck hunters do it in a number of different ways. I didn't always have a dog. We always had dogs growing up, but I didn't always have a dog when I started off hunting on my own. And yes, somehow you got to hide. And so whether that's hiding in some cattails, or whether that's building a blind on top of a boat, or whether it's building a little blind on shore, or whether it's covering yourself up in a cornfield and pulling stuff over top of you, or there's as many blind configurations probably as there is hunters, but somehow ducks have very good eyesight, and somehow you have to figure out how to blend into your surroundings so they don't see you.
I have a brother and I know other hunters, and I know for geese they put out decoys. Does one put out decoys for ducks? Does that work?
Yeah. So most kinds of waterfowl, the idea is that, yeah, you have some sort of decoys out that when a duck is flying over, it's seeing those decoys and of course mistaking them for other ducks. And there's a whole art to setting up those decoys in such a way that will allow ducks to land in the right spot for you to shoot them efficiently. And depending on the species, there's different sizes of spreads and different types of decoys. And the biggest change in decoys, in my lifetime was when I was maybe, 9 or 10, the spinning wing decoy came on the market, and I'd say it really changed the way that duck hunters hunt. And that's just basically a decoy that's got two spinning wings on it. And those, one of the sides of the spinning wing is white and the other side is dark. And so it creates a flash that when you see it from the air, it looks like just a little flash every second. And what that looks like to a duck is it looks like a duck fluttering down into a decoy spread. And so it really adds an element of realness, of lifelikeness to that spread that wouldn't otherwise have it if you didn't have it. And that really gave hunters that had that spinning wing decoy a competitive advantage, especially on large areas where there's lots of different hunters. So I grew up hunting Lake Odessa, and at any given time, there might be 50, 60, 70 hunters out on this 5,000-6,000 acre area. And so ducks can see all those different spreads from the air. And those that had that spinning wing decoy had a big advantage. Well, as you can imagine, the next year, everyone had the spinning wing decoy. And now it's almost become an essential part of the spread. And then there's schools of thought around, are ducks learning what that is and avoiding it, and of course I don't know that anyone really knows, but it's become a standard part of the decoy spread for waterfowl hunters across North America.
Oh, for goodness sakes, it sounds like there's a lot of technology into duck hunting. We're going to take a little break here and come right back and talk more about ducks and what they taste like. You're listening to KHOI. This is the Don Alana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. The Don Alana Kitchen. We're talking to Nick Oady. We're talking to Nick Oady about hunting, ducks. You have dogs that assist you. How do you get dogs to do that? I would just stay in the nice little warm blind with the thermos of coffee myself. How do you get dogs to do that for you? To retrieve?
Well, I have golden retrievers. And I grew up with Labrador retrievers, and they're pretty similar in many ways, and that they've certainly been bred to do the job of retrieving. So they get pretty excited about the opportunity to do that. Now, harnessing and fine tuning that native instinct is not the easiest thing, and I in no way claim to be any sort of expert in that end of it. I'm mainly getting them out there in the field and letting them learn from experience. And of course, every hunting dog owner probably wishes that they had more time to train their dogs, but all the other parts of life end up getting in the way. But the basics, when we were just talking about duck hunting before the break, and with ducks, you're typically fixed. So you're hidden somewhere, you get your decoys out, and you're waiting for the ducks to come, and your dog's there hiding with you. And after you shoot a duck, then you're going to send that dog out to retrieve the duck. And so they run or swim out and use their nose to find that duck. And of course, if the duck is still alive, it's much more challenging in most situations than if the duck's dead. And so there may be some sort of a pursuit either on land or on water for ducks, you really hope that they get on land because the dog has a really big advantage because you're now facing a duck out of water. In the water pursuits, dogs are kind of following them with their nose, and a lot of times ducks will dive. And that creates a problem for dogs because they can't dive as easily as ducks can. Although good duck dogs will stick their head underwater and grab a duck from underwater. So Yeah, and then in an ideal world, the dog brings the duck right back to you and sits back at their post and waits for the next dog or next duck to arrive.
Oh, three cheers for the dogs! That's what you were describing before the break. Hunting in southeastern Iowa on a big place where there were many hunters. So the ducks fly over. Bang, bang, bang. People take shots. Ducks fall out of the sky. How does the dog know which is your duck?
So I guess to clarify a little bit like I said, Lake Odessa, a large oxbow lake right on the Mississippi River. People are spread out. So there's not people hunting right next to each other. They're hunting, you know, hundreds of yards from each other in most situations and farther. So it's pretty clear which ducks you're hunting in an isolated area. However, there are situations where you maybe had a flock of ducks come in and you shot two or three out of a flock, especially if you're hunting with friends. And so a good duck dog will its hunter will give it a line. It'll say, go get this one first. It goes out, gets that one, comes back. You give it another line. It goes out and gets that one and comes back. And the best duck dogs, which my dad has told me this story many times, they see all the ducks that go down. And in fact, they see the ducks that you didn't see. So my dad tells a story about his first dog. And he said a flock came in, several ducks went down. He sent Buck out to get all the ducks. When he thought they were done, Buck was still chomping at the bit to retrieve more ducks. And he said, I don't know what you're doing, but I'll let you go. And he let him go, and he went and retrieved another duck that no one even knew was down. So a good duck dog really does improve the ability of a hunter to harvest birds and also to make sure that they do get all the birds that they have managed to shoot.
One last question. You were talking about teal before, a small sort of duck. What does teal taste like?
Well, so the two species of teal that we have in Iowa, and there's more teal throughout the world, but the two species we have are blue-winged teal and green-winged teal. And we always call blue-winged teal butterballs because it seems like a lot of them have a thick layer of fat around them. And to me, teal are one of the best tasting ducks. You get that skin crispy and the fat rendered and they're a pretty good eating duck. But in general, they're the same as other ducks in that the breast is a dark meat. So you can think about ducks like you can think about beef. So, the breast is a steak that you're going to cook to medium rare or rare. And the legs are like the brisket where you're going to cook until they're falling apart tender. So that's kind of the difference, and that's how I always think about ducks. But to me, ducks are some of the best eating meat out there.
Oh, good. Ducks. Besides ducks and all the wonderful things that you've shared with us, you also have a garden. You recently bought a house in Ames, and you've got a garden space, and you just can't stop gardening. And so, what sort of things in your garden were successes this year?
So, at the start of COVID, you know, we thought, well, we're going to have a lot of time to ourselves here at the house. Might as well put in a big garden. And we were thinking about doing some work in the backyard. So we thought it's not going to be a problem to till up most of it, plant a garden. And then we came into a large number of tomato and pepper plants from Seed Savers because they couldn't do their sales in person this year. So we took some of those and planted a lot of tomatoes and peppers. And they've all of it's been really pretty successful, especially the tomatoes and the different pepper varieties. One of the favorite things that I've grown that I'd never purchased anyone growing it locally is a shishito pepper, which to my understanding is a pepper that is Japanese in origins, I think. I'm not 100% sure on that, but it's really common as a tapas dish in Spain. So you go to these bars in Spain and you pay a few dollars and you get a small little tidbit, little bite to eat. And one of those bites is a whole shishito pepper that's been blistered in a cast iron skillet with some oil and salt and pepper. And you just eat the whole thing, seeds and all. You grab the stem and you chomp off the rest of it and chew it up and eat it whole. And it's a mild flavor. Now, I had read that 1 out of 10 shishito peppers is hot. I've eaten probably 150 off of this plant, and I haven't encountered a hot one. So I don't know what to make of that. But it's a mild but very flavorful pepper, and it couldn't be easier to grow or eat. So that's been one of the big, one of the things that I've really enjoyed, just being able to grab one of those things and either grill it or cook it in a pan this summer.
That pepper was a new find for me this summer. I ran across some at the local farmer's market and bought some there. As I understand it, it's S-H-I-S-H-I-T-O, shishito peppers, kind of long, skinny pepper. And yes, they're good. Any other garden favorites?
I've grown a whole bunch of species of peppers, and it's one of the things that's been really fun is, you're typically used to getting a poblano pepper green in the grocery store, an Anaheim green, most of the time green bell peppers are the good looking ones in the grocery store, and the red ones maybe don't look so good. Well, when you have your own garden, you can let everything ripen to red. And so I've been able to do that, eat red Anaheims and red poblanos, which is nice because they are a little bit sweeter, but I think the complexity of the flavor also is enhanced once you really get it ripe. I'm in a CSA with a local veggie farmer, Kate Soko, and she likes to pick all of her peppers red because she thinks, or she told me anyway, that she thinks that a green pepper is just another unripe vegetable. And then there's some cases where you want to eat unripe vegetables, but in the majority of the cases, you want to let it ripen. And so that's been really fun to eat all those peppers in various stages. Of course, I'm eating them green too, but then you have the flexibility and the ability to let it get to whatever stage of ripeness you want. I've noticed that with tomatoes too. So everyone talks about how good a dead ripe tomato is, which is certainly true, but there's times when you want that little bit of tartness in there where you want it to be red, but not red, 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 red. You want it to be, for this sandwich, I want a little bite to it. So maybe I want to pick it in between green and red. So I think that's one of the fun things about having a garden.
Oh, it certainly is. And I want to put a plug in too for ripe peppers. Since I've been growing peppers, I agree with Kate. Green, a green pepper is all right. If you want something to put in a still life, perhaps, or just for looks, put it. No, I like things. And most peppers do ripen. They ripen to yellow. They ripen to orange. Some of them ripen to black or dark purple. But most of them ripen to red, and they're a real fine thing. I've been growing a pepper for years called a Topepo Rosso. I get it from an Italian seed company. Topepo Rosso means little pepper. A thick-walled golf ball size, two baseball size, kind of flattish, very thick-walled. And that, too, once that gets red, a red pepper is a joy. I want to mention another pepper I've talked about on the show, and they're just coming ripe now. I ran across one from a seed company, what's it called? Row 7 Seed Company. And the pepper is called habanera. It is a cross between a habanero and a sweet pepper. And so it's haba for the habanero and nada for not, because it is not hot. It has all the taste. It's a tasty pepper, and that ripens orange. It's about the size of your longest finger, except it's very plump, kind of wrinkly, and it is orange. I probably cheated with this. I kept a plant of that last year as a house plant, and it kept growing all winter. The little peppers that came in the house as a house plant kept coming, but they were teeny tiny little things. And as soon as I moved it outside, I got full size peppers. They were very, very nice. Nick, do you have a favorite tomato?
You know, I think this year it's in between two varieties. One is the hillbilly potato leaf, which is a big beefsteak heirloom variety. Just nice, really, really good for sandwiches and stuff like that. And one that you turned me on to, which is it's Aunt Ruby's German Pink?
Aunt Ruby's German Green.
Yeah. Well, I got a couple of those transplants from you, and I've grown them, and that's about my favorite as far as a ripe tomato to slice and just eat plain with nothing on it. That's it's delicious. Really, really complex between the tartness and the sweetness, and it's just a really good tomato.
Oh, for goodness sakes, Aunt Ruby's German Green. You have to be a gardener and a garden lover to deal with that Aunt Ruby's German Green, because you never quite know when it's ripe, because it is green, but it tastes like a tomato. I love Aunt Ruby's German Green, some of my favorite tomatoes. I also, surprisingly, I grow a lot of different kinds, and I've always loved an orange tomato called persimmon, kind of a medium-sized slicer, orange persimmon. And I usually plant some Brandywines just because, well, you know, we should try those. This year I got a variety pack. Brandywine evidently is so popular that everybody is, the seed houses are breeding them in all kinds of different colors. You can get pink, black, yellow, orange, gold, red. And so, all right, we're going to kind of see which ones do what. I had the absolute best luck with gold Brandywine, a big gold slicer. It didn't split. It's still going strong. The other Brandywines kind of go the way of all flesh. Of course, they get a little overly made and a little overly ripe. But these gold Brandywines have just done so well in my garden, despite the derecho and the woodchuck, which ate quite a few of them. I had good luck with that this year, and I wouldn't have thought. We'll take a little break here to remind you this is KHOI. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to Nick Odie today. Support KHOI. Go to khoifm.org. You can find the Donna Lana Kitchen website. There's a recipe page. And if you want to contact me, Lana, at www.onioncreekfarm@gmail.com. I'd love to hear, what's on your plate? And are you having any interesting garden things happening this year? For instance, I mentioned this a couple weeks ago. For some reason, I have got a September bloom of lilacs. Lilacs! Strange, strange thing. I think the Japanese beetle totally denuded my bush, and now they're coming back. So it's very odd and eerie, actually, to have a few lilacs blooming this time of year. So let us know. Write to me. Email lana@onioncreekfarm@gmail.com. Yes, we're back talking to Nick Odie here on the Donna Lana Kitchen. I have a little bit of a news item here. Anybody that puts up food this time of year needs canning lids. And canning lids, there is a run on canning lids, jar lids this time of year. There hasn't been a canning lid or canning rings to be had in this town in central Iowa for about a month now. I mean, I kind of start looking for them because I have early jelly things that I want to do. And no, grocery stores are out, farm stores are out. You look online and boy, oh boy, price wars online for canning jars and, canning lids especially. You can reuse the jars, which is what most of us do, is reuse those jars. So I kind of started thinking about, what about all these people? Can't they make canning lids? I mean, seems like something you could make. So I looked up the Ball Corporation, Ball. And we tend to trust certain canning jars and canning lids. And Ball Corporation has been a company for a long, long time. It was founded in 1880. Believe it or not, it started out as the Wooden Jacket Can Company in Buffalo, New York. They started out making containers for paint and kerosene and varnish. And they used wooden jackets around a liner, but the paint and kerosene and everything was corroding it. So they got into this glass container business, and then they got into the canning lid business because the Care Company ran out of business, and they took over their canning jar business and the mason jar business also. So they have been going great guns. I haven't called them directly to complain, but canning jars has been big in the Ball Corporation ever since 1884. And get this, they are, of course, you can't just make canning jars all your life. They keep going, and now they are into aerospace things. They're making things for, like, the Space Administration and Cape Canaveral and containers and things for the outsides of satellites. And you just can't be, maybe that's why there isn't any canning lids. They're all shot off into space. Oh, my goodness. A little bit on the Ball Corporation there. So they are not only make glass jars, but they're into metal containers, all kinds of packaging, and space manufacturing. So think of that. Also, remember that all this kind of manufacturing can cause environmental impacts, and for a few years they were right up there on the list of companies that produced toxic substances that were getting into our environment, the glass manufacturing and metal manufacturing. Supposedly they are doing a little better. So they're glycol ethers and trimethylene benzenes. You got to watch those, folks, because these things, although we need canning jars, we got to remember that this causes an impact on our environment. So good luck in finding canning jar lids, folks. I have a few left over from last year, and I'm going to probably use every single last one. Nick, do you can? Do you freeze? How do you preserve all your bounty?
Little of both. This year I thought, boy, we got a lot of tomato plants. I should probably figure out how to can or freeze some, but we've done a pretty good job of eating tomatoes for just about every meal, and we've managed to stay up with them and make pasta when we got a lot. And I do a lot of freezing of game and fruits and vegetables, and also some canning. I think this last year I pressure canned a lot of game stock made from bones of various hunted animals, and then also I guess the most recent thing that I put up was a batch of dilly beans. I do a little bit of that.
It's nice this time of year, even though you don't want to heat up the stovetop or heat up the canner. It is worth it. It's nice to have cans of things already. Nick, you work for Practical Farmers of Iowa, and because of the COVID pandemic, usually summer is a busy face-to-face time for farmers in Iowa, but you had to do things a little differently this summer. How did that go?
Yeah, so right at the outset of the pandemic, we realized that it wasn't going to be safe to promote large groups of people gathering, and so we kind of got our heads together and tried to figure out a way that we might promote connection and learning amongst farmers in a virtual way. And so we switched all of our field days. We usually have 40, 50, 60 field days a year. We switched those onto online events. And so we used both Facebook and Zoom to offer these events online. And in some cases, all the events were live, but sometimes we would have some video that the farmer had taken earlier in the year or earlier in the week. And then people could join and chime in and ask questions on either Facebook or Zoom and try to replicate some of the learning environment that happens at those fields, the farmer to farmer information sharing and just the sharing of the tips and tricks and things like that, and provide an opportunity to, even if you can't see their see them in person, while you might see the names of the people that you're missing. We're nearing the end of that. We have a handful left throughout the month of September. But all in all, it couldn't really compare to getting together in person and seeing all your friends from across the state. But it worked for the time that we had.
It did. It's so glad that people do have that access to that technology now. And one thing I noticed about your lineup of PFI virtual field days was that you had, sometimes you would return to a farm two or three times during the summer so you could see, well, for instance, garlic harvest at Grade A Farms. You saw the beginning, the middle, and the end, and it was, you didn't have to drive there each time. You could actually get a sense of these things actually happening throughout the season. A lot of interesting workshops that actually used video very well.
Yeah, I think, I hope we were able to take advantage of some opportunities that we wouldn't have otherwise been able to do, because trying to replicate the feel that you get from being able to shake the hand of your person that you hadn't seen for a couple of years or give someone a big hug, we're not going to replicate that online. And if we tried to do that, that's really bound for failure. And so we really thought about it, like, what's the opportunity that we have here? And so that, I think that was an idea that one of our PFI staff members, Liz Colby, had, to say, hey, well, we have the opportunity here to come back to see, like you said, Jordan Klassen talking about garlic throughout the summer. And instead of getting that one time snapshot, you get live updates throughout the summer. So, it gave us some opportunities for farmers to have a different insight into the farms of their fellow farmers. So, yeah, hopefully we got to see a positive things come out of it.
I think so too. We're missing a lot of things during these unusual times, but we still can talk to each other and still learn things. That's good. And we learn things too about hunting. I have to always remind people, I remind myself too, that hunting is a whole thing that we think, oh, that's what guys do out there. But things end up back in the kitchen. And I always like to try new things. Turtle. I don't suppose anyone's ever used a turtle like a ready-made crock pot and just cooked the turtle in its own shell. I don't suppose that'd work. No. Probably not. But there's all kinds of new things. And I'm glad you had such a good tomato and pepper year. Ah, it was good. My peppers are not, it's not a great pepper year, but boy, did I have tomatoes. How can you complain? You've got all that kind of stuff. So thank you, Nick Odie, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, and I look forward to being back on soon.
Good, good. Thanks, Nick. Bye-bye. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. The Donna Lana Kitchen happens every Tuesday at noon on this fine radio station. Repeats 7 p.m. on Tuesday. Support KHOI. We had music today by Peter Ostrushko, original tune inspired by the Battle of Bull Run in the town of Manassas, Virginia. This town was originally called Manassas Junction, and the tune is called Manassas Junction. Take care of each other. Wear a mask. Be kind. My name is Lana Noctigal. We had great engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.